This is a joint work with Yehuda Linden from Bar Ilan University. And for those who didn't see the title, I'll provide an alternative title. So basically what we're doing here, we're providing security for IAO's secure two-party computation protocol. So we're providing security against malicious parties. We're doing this using cut and choose techniques instead of zero knowledge, and I explained this. We keep everything very efficient, and we prove security in the ideal real simulation paradigm, as I'll explain later. Okay? So the nice thing here is that we don't use any zero knowledge proofs, just cut and choose, and yet we prove security in the full simulation of simulating the whatever adversary we can learn in the real model. Okay.
You're not using generic.
We're not using generic, even it's so, okay, there's some, we use something, it's hard to pinpoint where the zero knowledge proof hides in our construction. And in this talk, I'm gonna first recall secure computation and IAO's protocol for secure two-party computation. Then I'm going to describe our construction. In particular, I'm gonna highlight the gadgets we use in the protocol to enable the proof. Because we had to add some non-intuitive changes to enable us to prove the protocol to be secure. So secure two-party computation, we have the same guys that that Rebecca used. We have Bob and Alice, and they want to compute some. Bob has input x, Alice has input y. They want to compute some function f of x and y, then learn nothing else. And in this, to me, this should be as if they had a trusted party, someone they all trust and love, and they know that he's not going to cheat them. So that in this model, this is the ideal model where we have a trusted party, they could just send their inputs to a trusted party, and trusted party computes the function and tells the result to Alice and Bob. And one, what we want to do is we want to do the same, achieve the same result in a scenario where we don't have a trusted party. So just communicate with each other, and this, still at the end, they learn f of x and y and nothing else. So f might reveal some information to Alice and Bob, but we want this to be the only information that Alice and Bob learn. So for instance, if they want to compute x plus y, so obviously Alice from x plus y and from y, she can learn x. Okay? In this case, f reveals everything to Alice, so Bob could have just sent x to Alice. But if you think about other functions, then some information might be revealed from y and f and x and y, but we don't want Alice to learn any more information. And the same should hold true for Bob. And, okay, we're thinking about cryptographic applications here. So we have adversaries, so the parties are not necessarily good. And here we can talk about semi-honest adversaries, which do whatever we tell them to do, but try to learn something from what they learn in the protocol about the other party's input. And we can also think about malicious adversaries that can do anything. So say if the protocol tells the party, say, to send x, an encryption of x squared, and so on, then a semi-honest adversary is going to send these values, and a malicious adversary can do anything it wants. And of course, it's harder to prove security against malicious adversaries, and this is what we try to achieve here. So IAO showed, or at least,
well,
this is
in the same paper mentioned by Amos.
No, it's a different paper by Amos published. No, okay. So IAO's secure two-party computation is a generic protocol which enables two parties to compute any function they wish without revealing anything more than the output of the function to the other party. And the protocol goes like this. The first party, we're going to call the parties P1 and P2 from here. So P1 constructs the binary circuit computing here. So every function can be described as a circuit. So P1 constructs the circuit and then it garbles it. So what does it mean? So this is a gate in the circuit. It has wires coming in and a wire going out. So P1 generates garbled values for the wires. So instead of having values of 0 and 1 on this wire, wires are I, J, and K, we're going to have a string the random string ki0 replacing 0 on this wire, and the random string ki1 replacing 1 on this wire. And this goes for all wires. So essentially, we just replace 0 and 1 with random strings. Okay? So these are the garbage values of the wires. And actually, in the execution, in the when we're going to evaluate the function, P2 is going to learn one garbage value per wire, but it's not going to learn which original value this garbage value corresponds to. So it learns, say, this string, and doesn't know whether it corresponds to 0 or to 1. So next, Yao showed how when you have a string, one of these strings and one of these strings, you can compute G of these two values, or rather the garbage string corresponding to G applied to the garbage values here. So this is done by actually encrypting the garbage value of the output wire using the garbage values of the input wire. So suppose that the wire was an AND wire, okay? So if you had 0 and 0 as inputs, the output is 0. So you encrypt the garbage value of 0 for the output wire using the garbage values of 0 and 0 for the input wire. So if you had 1 and 1, the output is 1. So you encrypt KL1 using KI1 and KJ1. Okay. So basically, you construct this table of four encryptions for every gate. And you do this for every gate. This is what P1 does. And since these Ks are used as encryption keys, they should be long enough to be keys of a symmetric encryption system, say 128 bits long. And the table contains four encryptions per gate. So what happens here is if you get two garbage values, one garbage value per input wire, you can compute the garbage value of the output wire. Okay, and that's it. So this is what P2 should do. So P1 sends to P2 the tables encoding each circuit gate and the garbage value of its own inputs. And now P2 should learn the garbage value of its input. So to do that, they run an oblivious transfer per bit, per input bit of P2. Okay? So in the oblivious transfer, P1 offers P2 to learn one of two strings, the garbage value corresponding to 0 and the garbage value corresponding to 1 on this input wire. P2's input is going to be its input bit, 0 or 1 for this wire. And then the protocol lets her learn the garbage value corresponding to the input bit. After doing these oblivious transfers, P2 has garbage values for all input wires, both belonging to P1 and to P2. And then for every gate, you can compute the garbage value of the output wire, and then it's possible to go all the way to the end of the circuit and compute the output of the circuit. Okay, so this is what P2 is doing. And actually, this is a nice result, which is good for every circuit. And actually, we did an implementation of this system, of this construction. So we have the Fairplay system, which was done by Noam Issan, Dalia Matri, Yaron Sela, and myself, which actually implements this. Okay? And then Yao's paper didn't have proof of security. So last year, this year, Yehuda Linder and myself wrote a detailed proof of this protocol for the semi-honest adversary case, and we actually had to do some minor modifications to prove security. And it's a pretty, it's we have, so the proof appears in the equipped archive, and it's a pretty long proof. Everything, you can rest assured, everything here is made. You can prove security for us in our construction. And two things to note here. First, the major computational overhead here is the oblivious transfer. Everything else computationally is only symmetric encryption or decryption, so it's very efficient. The main computational bottleneck is doing the oblivious transfer. This is both, you can see it by examining the construction, and it also follows from the system that we implement. You can see that while running the system. And another nice thing about the Fairplay system is that we implemented the general compiler. So basically, you write a protocol in a high-level language, something like C or Java. And we have a compiler which translates this protocol to a circuit. and then another compiler which translates the circuit to two programs that Alice and Bob can run. And you can download the compilers and run for yourself. Okay. So this is Yao's protocol. So just one thing to note, the original protocol only P2 evaluates the circuit and learns the output. So of course P2 can send the output to P1. So one technicality is what happens if you want P1 to learn one output and P2 to learn another output, different outputs. So we don't want P2 to learn that output. So we can simply say construct a slightly different circuit which takes the original circuits and adds a layer which encrypts and authenticates the output that P1 should learn using keys that only P1 knows. And this is actually very simple because, I mean, you don't need any, you know, fancy encryption here. You can do just something similar to one-time path. So P1 will have additional inputs A, U, and V, and the output is P2's input, and P1's output when we add, where we add A to that output. So this is encryption with a one-time path, and this authentication. And so basically, P2 learns all these values. She keeps these to herself, and then these values don't tell P2 anything about P1's output. She sends them to P1. P1 can decrypt his output from here, and he can verify using these two values that P1 didn't change the information she sent. So basically, given this observation, we should only care about protocols where P2 learns the output and she sends something to P1.
Okay. What do you mean secure against malicious P2? You could deny any output, right?
Okay, so if you're talking about security definitions, there's the issue of early termination. There are some things we cannot prevent. Okay. One of them
so
is
I
P2.
You're talking about honest and curious, no? You're talking about malicious?
We're talking about malicious.
With a board.
With a board, and we don't do anything to provide fairness. So we don't discuss fairness. Okay. So okay, let's talk about security against malicious parties. So we can use the general compiler of Goldratt and Kalin and VictorZone, which enables us to add security against malicious adversaries to every protocol. This shows feasibility, but if you want to implement this, it requires something like a zero knowledge proof per gate, which it's rather costly. And we actually, our goal is not to add any public key operations in addition to the original, to the oblivious transfers we use in the first stage. And there's a recent work of Mohassel and Franklin where we actually do something very similar to what we do. They show how to change Yao's protocol to be secure against malicious adversaries, and they use cut and choose the same as we do. In a different way, but you know, they use cut and choose exactly. As we do. The differences are that in their protocol, only one party learns the output, not both parties. And there are some subtle issues which make it harder to let the two parties learn outputs. And also our protocol has all kinds of gadgets which we needed, you know, to prove security in the ideal real model paradigm. And we don't know how to prove security without these gadgets. Yeah.
Didn't your previous slide say that it's not a problem if only one party learns the output?
Okay, so what happens here is that P2 learns the output and she sends something to P1. Mm-hmm. Okay? When you run this protocol, there's a final step where P2 sends something to P1. But the problem lies in this step because P1, as I'll show you in a few minutes, can change his input so that P2 will abort if P2's input satisfies some. Okay. So what I showed here is that P1 and P2 have inputs. I showed that the protocol could be one where P2 learns an input and sends an output and sends something to P1. The problem is in the last step, P2 sending something to P1. If you don't change the protocol a little bit, then this last step might reveal some information to P1. Okay, so you have to be careful to enable this last step. Without this, without the additional steps that we need to add, then we can only implement protocols where P2 learns an output and P1 learns nothing. Okay?
So either are you convincing us to not delete the slide or to yes, believe it for your result? But
no, there's no contradiction between the two slides. Okay?
This is a general reduction from the symmetric case with the board to the asymmetric case. I mean, this reduction is a general reduction, right? From
This is
protocol is securing the asymmetric case, and this reduction will give you protocol is securing.
Okay, this is a general reduction from to a case where P2 learns an output, and then she sends something to P1. It's hard, unless you take some care, it's hard to implement the last step, where P2 sends something to P1. So unless you take some care, you can only implement protocols where P2 learns something and P1 learns nothing.
No.
The last round where P2 sends something to P1 might reveal information about P2's input. This information is revealed. I mean, P1 learns this information because if he's really malicious, P2 will have to abort. Okay? And if she aborts, she doesn't send this last message, and then he learns something. So unless you take care, you can only implement protocols where P2 has an input and P1 has no input.
Can you say that the failure of the reduction for the Mahasal Franklin protocol, does that basically exhibit why it's not provably secure in the kind of ideal real model? So you're saying the reduction, where if I take any protocol, which is
no, you can think about. Okay, I didn't see no.
Does this fail the full Mahasal Franklin, or does it not?
No, Mahasal Franklin is good for different. They should correct me if I'm wrong, but they're good for functions in which P2 learns an output and P1 learns no output at all.
And if you had a function where they both learn an output, could you do what they did and then do this? And then
no, you had to. You have to add something additional to
them. That's not written in this slide.
It's not written in this slide. It's written in ten slides down the road in my mind. Okay? So, yeah.
What if they just switch the roles and you just run the protocol twice?
No, the issue is that P1 learns something. P1 can kind of force P2 to abort if P2's input, say, has zero in the first bit. Okay? A malicious P1, as I'll show you in 5 minutes, can cause P2 abort. Can cause P2 to abort if her input, say, has zero. Okay? So, therefore, okay, if you have a protocol where only P2 has an output, she aborts because P1 did something bad, but P1 doesn't know if she aborts or not because she doesn't have to send him anything in the last step. Okay? But if she has to send him something in the last step, he learns whether she aborts.
But well, why does that say that you can't run Franklin protocol twice?
Because. Okay, you can run that protocol twice, but you don't get your intended outcome because you run it twice and P2 doesn't learn anything.
No, like run it basically of two different, completely different functions.
So simple. Okay,
and you run
let's finish with this. I'll finish here. But basically, what happens is you and I want to learn some function of our inputs. We run it first, and I'm P2, and I abort. Okay. So if I tell you that I abort, then you learn something about my input, so I must hide it for you. Yeah. And then you want me to run the protocol again with you so that you learn this function. So something here is...
Well, it's just a different function. You just define the function differently. So you have two different functions.
Okay, so let's continue. Okay. So let's talk about what we did. So we have an efficient protocol for malicious... against the queue against malicious adversaries. We use cut and choose. Both parties might have outputs, different outputs if they want. The proof is rather complex, but the protocol is efficient. Namely, the number of oblivious transfers is the same up to a constant parameter, which is equal to 4, actually, as the original protocol, and communication is multiplied by a statistical security parameter. So if you want the adverse, you can only cheat in probability, which is exponentially small in S, you send S times as much communication. Okay, so if you want security, the adverse, you can send, you know, cheat in probability 1 to 1,000,000, you should have S to be, you know, of the order of 20. Okay, 20 multiplied by some constant, which I'll go into that constant later. And we have a simulation-based proof, which is strictly harder than using separate proofs of privacy and correctness, but it gives you a better result because now you can use this protocol as a sub-protocol in other protocols.
What does it mean, strictly harder proof?
Okay, let's go into that. Just show you. Let's not go into that, but I'll show you why it's good to have this type of security. So, for instance, Gagan Agarwal and Nina Mishra and I had a protocol for computing the median security. And then we used a sub-protocol which had to compare two numbers. And we proved that our protocol is secure even against malicious adversaries if this sub-protocol is secure against malicious adversaries. Okay? So now if we have, you know, a generic protocol for constructing secure protocols for any circuit, say for comparing two numbers, we can plug it in that median protocol, and everything is not, you know, and just plug and play. Plug it in, and you use the full protocol, and the proof is very. You have a very simple proof that the full protocol is secure. So, you know, before that, we said, okay, our protocol is secure against malicious adversaries. You just have to find a protocol secure against malicious adversaries for comparing two numbers. Now, giving this work, you don't have to work too hard. Just have to, you know, design a circuit for computing two numbers, apply this construction to it, and plug it in our, say, median protocol. Okay. So what can a malicious adversary do here? What do we want to achieve? So what can P1 do? So something that can definitely do is construct a circuit which doesn't compute F, but rather some other F type. F prime. So the fork solution to prevent such behavior, so you can either use zero knowledge proofs, where P1 proves that the circuit is correct, or you can do something that we call cut and choose, where P1 constructs, say, S different copies of the circuits and commits to them, and then P2 asks P1 to open some of these circuits. P2 checks that the open circuits are correct, then she runs the other circuits and has the output. So the intuition here is that if P1 tries to cheat, then with good probability P2 will identify a bad circuit here. Okay? I don't want you to, I mean, this is not, no, this is not foolproof. I mean, this is just, you know, the intuition. Okay, I'll show you later how to actually implement this.
What is open? Because the circuit contains already.
So basically, okay, you have to do something against it. But this is the basic intuition we have. So suppose we do that. Is it better than zero knowledge proof, just to verify, to make sure that there's some sense in what we're trying to do here? So suppose you're doing zero knowledge proof. So say you have to do 10 exponentiations per gate to prove that the gate is correct. I invented 10. It could be, no, I didn't check. But say 10 exponentiations per gate, and say you can compute 20 exponentiations per second, so then you can process 20 gates per second. I invented these numbers, but I think they're in the ballpark. Now, what about cut and choose? So each gate has 512 bits, and suppose you can send 1 megabit per second. I can send it from home, so if you're using the LAN, you can send much more. So here you can send 2,000 gates in a second.
I'm
thinking about a generic protocol where the
which one is
okay. The party which constructs the circuit. I invented these numbers, but okay. Let's have this.
Numbers are very
okay. Okay. I have okay. saying that the party which constructs the circuit wants to prove that every gate is correct. Okay, so to do a zero knowledge proof. Okay, I was thinking about protocols which show equality of commitments and stuff like that, or relations between commitments. So usually, for every equality or relation, you do an exponentiation or two, and each gate has four relations involving some parameters. So maybe you need 10 exponentiations, maybe you need 100 or 20. It's just, you know, to find out that there's some, you know, that it makes sense. So basically what we're trying to do here is to replace computation with communication. And I'm trying to just to verify before I'm going into details that it makes sense. Okay. And what this, back of the envelope of computation shows that there's like, with these parameters, communication is two orders of magnitude faster than computation. So it makes sense to trade computation with communication. You know, I haven't checked a real implementation, but it makes sense to add something to communication and save a computation. So that's what this guy wants to show.
And probably if you had to reduce it to physical ability, but something like a circuit set, probably would have been worse.
I think so. It depends on the reduction.
Yeah, okay, but reduction you can imagine. The circuit checks the circuit.
Yeah, so then it's going to be much worse. Okay. So it makes sense to aid communication to aid computation with communication. Okay, so what do we have? Okay, there are some problems when you want to use cut and choose. So one problem is inconsistent outputs. So,
sorry, I'm still confused. Typically, when you prove a zero knowledge that the proof that all the gates are correctly constructed, you don't do it per gate. Take the entire statement. It could be that amortized the cost of proving the entire statement is cheaper than doing this, right? Because you don't have to do it.
It could be, but
when you have the verification, the complexity of verification algorithm, yeah, the circuit is probably worse than what you would say.
Well, let's say, okay.
Maybe.
Let's say it differently. I don't know. I don't think that anyone tried to actually implement the Gauss protocol against Mitchell's partners. And I think that what I'm going to show here is you can actually implement it pretty efficiently. Okay, you can actually implement it and run it. So maybe I will leave it to a challenge to construct a zero knowledge proof which could rival the efficiency of this one. Okay. So something we should care about when we're using cut and choose. So suppose P2 asks P1 to open, say, half of the circuits. P2 sees that these circuits are fine, and then P2 evaluates the other half of the circuits, and not all of them provide the same output. Okay? So here definitely P1 cheated, because if P1 was acting correctly, all circuits should compute the same function. So maybe P2 should abort because P1 cheated. But actually, in this case, P1 might learn some information. And here's an example. Suppose P1 constructs S minus 1 circuits which compute F, and one circuit computes F only if P2's input is 0. Okay? So in this case, with probability 1/2, the bad circuit is not revealed when P2 checks the circuits. But in this case, P1 learns whether P2's input is 0 or not. Okay? So P2 should not abort, and what should she do? So what she can do is she compute the output of all the circuits she evaluates, and then output the majority value. And this is good because in order to cheat, P1 has to create at least S over 4 bad circuits. But then with with all but exponentially small probability, P1 is going to find one of these bad circuits in the first place. Okay, so we know that P2 should output the majority value of the circuits.
So these are Boolean circuits.
Okay, no. Maybe they have many output wires. The proof shows that there is a majority value. Okay, Okay.
With high probability.
So you're afraid that what happens if they say the output can be, say, could have a million values, the proof shows that with high probability, one of the values would appear in more than half the evaluated circuits. Okay? Okay, another problem. P2 checks that the circuits are fine, but P1 might provide different inputs for different circuits. This is actually the main technical difficulty in constructing the solution. So does this matter? So if it provides different inputs, then the circuits compute different values. So for instance, suppose you wanted to compute the internal product between P1 and P2's inputs. Now suppose that P1 provides to every circuit a different input, say, which has 1 in one coordinate and 0 in all other coordinates. Then this circuit is going to output the corresponding bit of P2's input. Okay? And then P2 outputs the majority value, which is essentially 1 if the Hamming weight of her input is greater than SF2 and 0 otherwise. So here P1, by playing with his inputs, changing his inputs, can force P2 to compute a different function. So to do that, we must verify that P1's inputs are consistent. The question is how to do that, and I'll show you how to do it. And another problem is how to show a simulation-based proof of security, say how to extract inputs. And I'll show you how to do that too. So the protocol is, it goes like that. The parties first have to agree to a circuit computing the function. Then P1 constructs S copies of the circuit and commits to them. Then P2 uses oblivious transfer to learn the garbage values of her circuit. Okay? And then P1 sends the commitments to the circuits to P2. Actually, the order here is important. You should do the oblivious transfer before sending the commitments. Then P2 asks P1 to open half the circuits, and she verifies them. And if she's happy, P1 sends the garbage values of his inputs, and the parties evaluate the remaining circuits, and then P2 outputs the majority result. So how are we going to,
Can you just pause one moment and let us read the protocol? So what do you mean by commit to them without sending the commit?
Okay, so it can commit to them here, okay?
And then I think that was Joe's question about what about P1's input? Are they hardwired
into the circuit? They're not hardwired. So basically, for each input wire of P1, there could be two different values, one corresponding to 0 and one corresponding to 1. So here, where P1 sends to P2 the garbage values of its input wires, he sends one of these two values.
So when it commits to circuit, you mean the garbage circuit?
Yeah. Yeah?
So all the circuits have to use the same garbage values for P2's inputs?
No. Each circuit has different garbage values.
Yeah. Because it says it only uses N of T's for all the circuits, across all the circuits.
Okay, so this is something.
Right.
So what happens, we have, okay, you have S circuits, and P1 uses different garbage values in all circuits. So consider one input wire of P2. P2 should learn the values corresponding to a 0 in this wire in all circuits, or the values corresponding to 1 in this wire in all circuits. So in the oblivious, you can do one oblivious transfer where P2 either learns all the values corresponding to 0 or all the values corresponding to 1. It's a very long oblivious. Well, the data is long, but you only do one oblivious transfer. And the overhead is the same as doing oblivious transfer of short. Okay, so how can you prove consistency of P1's inputs? That's the major problem here. So here's one approach, which is not good. So P1 could commit to the garbage values. So consider one wire of P1's input. P1 could commit to the garbage values of 0 on this wire in all S circuits, or commit to the garbage values of 1 on this wire in all circuits. So basically, it's one wire, it has different garbage values in each of the S circuits, and P1 constructs two sets of commitments. Okay? Now, for the checked circuits, P1 opens the commitments which correspond to checked circuits. Say this first circuit is checked by P2, then P1 opens these two commitments, and P2 verifies that the commitments are indeed to the right values. Okay? Now, when they evaluate the remaining circuits, P1 should prove that for this wire, either all the values it provides come from the first set, or all of them come from the second set. Okay? Either from the first one or the second one. So this seems to do the work, and you can do these proofs using the proofs of partial knowledge of Kramer, Damsgaard, and Schoenker. But these proofs cost you basically an exponentiation per commitment here. So we have a total of S exponentiations per input wire, so a total of N times S exponentiations, and we want to have something like order of N exponentiations. So we want to get rid of this S number. So what we do, we use two cut and chooses. One for the circuits and one for the commitments. So maybe I'll show you this drawing here. So P1 constructs for every wire S sets of commitments. So this is for a single wire, for its first wire. So the first set actually it's actually a pair of two sets of commitments containing, so the first pair here might, the first commitment of the pairs has a commitment, say, to a zero, and then to the garbage value of zero for this wire in all circuits. And then the second set has a commitment to one, and the garbage values of one in this wire in all circuits. And then we repeat this S times. And this is only for a single wire. So the same value here, the garbage value of zero, appears in all sets. But in each set, P1 randomizes the order. So the sets, so in this pair, zero might come before one, and P1 comes before zero. So just from looking at the sets, you don't know whether the first item in this pair contains commitments to the zero value or to the one value of this Y in all circuits. Now, P1 sends all these sets to P2, and then they pick random strings, row prime, which essentially choose a subset of the circuits and a subset of the sets. Okay, those who correspond to, say, to one bit here will be checked, and the other will be evaluated. So we have checked circuits and evaluated circuits, checked sets and evaluated sets. So maybe I'll show it here. So what happens with checked circuits and checked sets? So for each checked circuit like this, P1 opens the commitments to the input wires, but only in checked sets. And it also opens the first commitment here. So what P2 does, it just verifies these commitments are indeed to the right value, and that they agree with the first item in the set. Okay, so here they are all commitments to the zero value, and here they are all commitments to the one value in the checked sets. Now, for evaluated sets, P1 opens, for evaluated circuits, P1 opens the values in evaluation sets. Okay? So this check set was checked, so it doesn't open anything here, but for this circuit, it opens the values in evaluation sets, which actually correspond to the value that he wants to have, want this wire to have when evaluating this circuit. So what should P2 check? So P2 should check that all these values come, so in each pair, all the values P1 opens come from the same row. So if this pair is constructed correctly, they all correspond either to 0 or to 1. And P2 should also check that all copies of the same value which correspond to the same circuit are actually the same. So actually, I think that I lost 99% of the audience here, But the proof shows that actually 99. Well, we only have 100 people.
what is the number of commitments over the square?
So we have a total of S squared commitments.
Aha, you found a number, yeah.
So basically the thing here is that in the check step, P1 opens the commitments in checked, well, half of the circuits are checked and half of the sets are checked. P1 opens the commitment in check sets for checked circuits, and it opens the commitment in evaluation sets for evaluated circuits. But it doesn't use any combination. So this enables P2 to verify that the sets are correct, but doesn't reveal to P2 which values P1 opens in the evaluation set. But let's just leave this. And this shows why this indeed proves consistency of P1's inputs, but let's go over here. Let's skip this slide. So what about P2's inputs? This is actually why it's hard for P2 to have an output. So it seems easy because P1 can commit to P2's original inputs, okay? And then for every input wire of P2 in the oblivious transfer, P2 can either learn that the commitment key is corresponding to a zero input or the ones corresponding to a one input. Okay, so it seems easy. And then the last step, P1 opens the check circuits and P2 learns that the values she learned here that correspond to check circuits are correct. So this it seems to be easy, but there is a subtle point. What P1 can do here is it can corrupt the commitment keys for one choice of P2's input, say for if P2's input is zero on this specific wire, and good keys if the input is one. So suppose P2's input is one. So then she gets the good keys, all the checks go well, and she computes them. She finishes the protocol, that's fine. But suppose her input, okay, in this case, she doesn't know that the inputs in the oblivious transfer corresponding to zero are bad, because the oblivious transfer hides these inputs from her. Now, what happens if her input is zero? Then she learns corrupt keys in the oblivious transfer, okay? And these bad keys, well, she sees that P1 is cheating, so she can complain. But if she complains, then P1 knows that her input was zero. So she cannot complain. But if she cannot complain, she cannot continue computing the function because we will not have anything to send P1 at the end of the protocol. Okay? So unless she keeps quiet, P1 learns something about her input. Okay? And if we have a protocol in which P1 should learn something at the end of the protocol, then he expects P2 to send something back to him. And if she keeps quiet, then he learns that she aborted here, so he learns something about her bit. Yeah.
So this comes back to some extent to the earlier discussion, but it seems that the problem is even more serious than what you're saying. It's a problem even in functions where, let's say, P1 has no output, because you want some kind of sequential composition property. This is the nice thing about the simulation paradigm, is that the distribution you're supposed to simulate includes the output of the honest player.
Yeah.
Right. So this protocol, so protocols of this type of property will never you.
Okay.
You know,
so
it's an attack.
Okay.
It's not merely that you can't.
Okay.
We don't know.
So okay. So what you're saying, if you didn't have a solution to this attack, then essentially P1 doesn't learn anything about P2's input because she keeps quiet. But it's not. This protocol is not good as a sub-protocol in real applications.
Right.
Because essentially what it says, that if P2 wants to hide her input from P1, she should keep quiet. Even if she doesn't get anything from the protocol, she must keep quiet. So I'll show you how to solve this. So there's an easy fix where we place each of P2's input wires with, say, S new wires, and the new value of this wire, we replace the original wire with the exclusive OR of S new input wires of P2. Okay? So why and P2, suppose she wants to have zero for this original input wire, then she chooses a random values for the new input wires as long as the XOR of these random values is equal to zero. Okay? equals 0. So she has 2 to the power of s minus 1 options.
Does it increase the number of little keys?
Well, it doesn't increase, but wait till the last step. So, okay. So if we go back, so this is doesn't seem good because the number of keys is increased by s, but.
Can you repeat what this accomplishes? I don't understand.
Okay. I didn't show you, I'll show you here why it works, but the step, what you
what
do
step?
Is,
yeah.
You take an input y of p2,
uh-huh.
You replace it with s new input wires, and...
So an input wire consists of 2 keys, one for the 0 and one for the 1.
It's just a circuit.
Ah, okay.
You replace each input wire with s new input wires, and you assign here the exclusive OR of these wires.
So you change the circuit as opposed to changing...
I change the circuit and I apply the protocol to the new circuit. What happens here is that if P1 corrupts one of these wires, then P2 can abort. So P1 learns, say, that P2's input on this wire was 0. But it doesn't reveal any information about the exclusive OR of these, all of these wires. So the only way for P1 to learn something about P2's input is to corrupt all S wires. So, but here, he can only learn something if P2's input is equal to some. So suppose he corrupts the 1 values in all of these wires. So P2 is going to complain, unless it happens that all of that her input here was 0, and she chose 0 in each of these wires. In this case, she doesn't see any corrupt value because she chose to run 0 here. But the probability of this happening is 2 to the minus s, okay, which is good for us. So P1 learns nothing except for exponentially small probabilities. So that's great. Unfortunately, the number of OTs is increased multiplied by factor of s. So the way to work against that is to reuse these wires. And I called this coding because of the name of this workshop, but you use some tricks. you use coding here, but coding is actually a fancy name for what we did here. But you can do this, replace the n original bits with 4 times n u bits, and the security is exponentially smaller than n. So that, okay. So now you only do 4 times n oblivious transfers. Actually replace n with 4 times the maximum of n of s. Okay. So just 2 more issues we had to handle. You want to choose which circuits to open. So this is done for P2 is asking P1 to open a random subset of the circuits. So it seems that naturally P2 should choose the circuits because she's checking P1. However, if you want to prove security against a malicious P2, you want to do simulation, so, okay, we want to cheat her and choose this subset as so it fits the simulation. So we will use, you know, a coin tossing protocol with commitments to let us, choose a random set of the sets and circuits, and it lets us cheat P2 in the simulation, okay? I didn't go into details, but that's what we do. And another thing here is that we should do the oblivious transfers before we open the commitments. We also need this for the simulation against the malicious P2, because here we can, what we do, we extract P2's input from the oblivious transfers, and then we construct circuits which we feed this input to the trusted party, we learn the output, and we construct bad circuits that always output this value. And then we can use them for the simulation. Yeah?
Can you really do the coin tossing the way you showed on the previous slide? Because that issue is a matter of
maneuverability. You think that there are issues of maneuverability here?
Because P1 can make his commitment for row 1 dependent on P2's commitment.
So you need either computationally hiding or computationally binding commitments here, but I didn't put the subset in this slide. But we handled this in the paper. Okay, so to prove security, basically what we want to do is whatever the corrupt party does in the real scenario, we can also do in the ideal model. So just 2 more slides. So how do we prove security against the malicious P1? So, okay, we want to show that it cannot do better than the ideal model. So we interact with the corrupt P1. We received the circuit commitments. We run the protocol once, and we have a role which decides which circuits P1 should open. We let P1 open the circuits. Then we wind the protocol back and run the protocol with a different choice of role. So then there are some circuits which P1 opened in this step, and then it used actually to evaluate in the second step. So in the second step here with a different role, in the first step it opened the circuit and told us everything about the circuit. In the second step, it actually gave his garbled values in their circuits. So from these values we learn his original input, we can feed this input to the trusted party, and then finish the simulation. Now, how can we do security against a corrupt P2? So we extract P2's input from the oblivious transfer. Then we send this input to the trusted party and learn F. Then we choose a random string, and then we construct the circuits which correspond to 1 bit in raw, which will be checked. We construct good circuits corresponding to 1 bit. And then the other circuits are one which always output F of X and Y. So what happens, P2 uses this rule to decide which circuits to check. The circuits she checks are actually the good circuits, and then she evaluates the other circuits which always output F of X and Y, no matter what P2 is doing. So these are the tricks we're using. So just to sum up everything, so we kept the basic structure of the house protocol, adding some stages, some steps. We're sending more copies. We have the same order of public key operations, but we had to add some tweaks to let the proof go through. The communication, we send S as many circuits and S square as many input wires. But we do the same order of public key operations, and the number of rounds is constant. So one question is what S should be. So suppose we want S to, security, adversary could cheat with probability 2 to the minus 20. So, okay. So in most of the proofs, we have the exponential probability is 2 to the minus S over 2 or S over 3. There's one item where we have S over 24, so we should, I think that we can make it better than S over 24. We haven't tried to improve that. Another nice thing to do is to find some trade-off between computation and communication. Instead of doing a full-blown zero proof for the whole circuit and doing our protocol, somehow do a little more oblivious transfers or exponentiations and a little less communication. And actually, you can actually think about implementing this protocol. I don't think it should be too hard. I might actually try to work on implementation, because you just have to send more circuits and do more checks.
You said that it basically doesn't use zero knowledge proofs, but I don't know whether you're familiar with the paper by Brassard, Chaume, and Crapaud. So that one is zero knowledge proof for circuits. So now, if you look at their zero knowledge proof, and if you look at your protocol, then they also use cut and choose. They also do commitments of garbled circuits. So have you looked at basically the ordinary way of running these protocols, but then use their zero-knowledge interactive proof and compare that result with your paper, with your result?
No, actually I haven't. The protocol is for the multi-party case, I think.
No, their protocol is an ordinary zero-knowledge interactive proof for any statement. But what they do is they look at the circuit, and they're going to also garble the circuit, and they're also going to do commitments of this garbling. It's very similar. They don't do half-half.
I haven't checked that. I should check this protocol.
It's a global, it's one of those things. The question is, what are you reducing it? Are you reducing it to, you want to reduce the thing to circuit verification.
But
what you have to take into account is the size of the circuit that verifies the circuit. That will appear in the expression. Whereas here, in this line thing, it's just additive. You have something you check with the I put plus just cut and choose on the basic circuit. You don't have anything else multiplied with the circuit. And whereas this approach seems to me that you have to have the size of the circuit that verifies the circuit, which is probably large, unless you have some kind of sophisticated.
Yes?
So I even though just
I didn't hear his conversation,
okay,
but
so maybe we should take it offline.